I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The movie never changes. It can't change, but every time you see it, it seems different because you're different. You see different things.
If you can't change anything because it's already happened, you may as well smell the flowers.
Hello, welcome to Rewatchability. It's the podcast where we revisit movies and TV shows of the past to see how they hold up today. I'm J.M. McNabb, and I'm joined, as always, by...
Blaine Waters.
And...
still Robert Lerone.
And we're back. We talked last week about what we'd be doing this week. And, of course, the movie we arrived at was 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
The 1995 Terry Gilliam movie about...
what
so much.
That's if the end of the world hasn't happened between last week and this week.
That's true. We're doing this partly inspired by the real life viral emergency that, you know, I guess our children will be like putting on the rubber suits with Christmas lights in it and trying to piece together what happened.
Let's be honest. This is probably being listened to by somebody who's been sent from the future or, you know, at least to the surface.
Oh, shit. They're going to think that we did it.
We did not. Do it, though maybe in a roundabout way we did. Humanity in general.
Okay. Yeah. Of course, yeah, 12 Monkeys, you know, big famous movie. We hope with this new format that you watched it along with us and are ready to get into the nitty-gritty of it. Before we get into that, I do want to say you can go to patreon.com/rewatchability and kick in a few bucks a month. And thanks so much to everybody that does that. It helps keep the show going. It helps keep Rob in the underground bunker in which he goes between episodes.
Keeping you in cans of beans.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, that's good.
It's your turn to hose them off after the show.
Okay, that's great. I thought I had things to do, but
make sure you use extra hot water.
There is so much to talk about with 12 Monkeys. Even just now when I said it's a movie about, my brain froze up because the words like time travel and plague and, you know, environmental
fate,
terrorism.
Yeah.
Naked Bruce Willis, you know, so many things.
There's a few bums in this. And I don't mean the homeless gentleman.
That's pejorative.
I mean like literally bare bums from...
Yeah.
From famous...
We get to see the sexiest ass of 1995.
That's true. Take that, Captain America.
Yes.
There's so much to talk about, so let's get right into the rundown. Rob, what happens in 12 Monkeys?
So, 12 Monkeys, it starts in 1996, which is the future, believe it or not. Because this was filmed in the past.
Wait, does it start in 1996?
Well, it tells us that in 1996 there was this big old plague and humanity was almost entirely wiped out and all the survivors had to go underground. That's what we're told at the beginning of the movie. And the next thing that we see is like a flashback. We see this scene of this man running through an airport and he seems like he's chasing somebody, but he gets shot. And then we see that this is being watched by a little boy. And then we see that it's being remembered by Bruce Willis, who is like some sort of prisoner in this underground society. And he's essentially like voluntold to to go on this mission to the surface where everything has been devastated. Like there's no human life up there. The animals are roaming free. He sees like a lion on a bank.
Yeah, sorry. How is this lion surviving in the winter in Philadelphia? That's
what
I
want to
know.
Shut up, Blaine.
Yeah, you don't know what sort of alpha species could thrive when there is a void in an apex predator.
Right. But they have no food stock. What are they eating? Cats?
Dead humans?
Dead humans, maybe.
He's probably right.
If you die and your cats are there, you know what's happening.
True.
Yeah. But so he does so well at this mission, he collects enough bugs that they voluntold him to go on another mission, a bigger mission.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't quite know what it is, but the next thing is he sort of is arrested in the past, which is 1996.
And we meet Madeline Stowe, the psychiatrist.
Yeah, that's right. She's playing this woman named Catherine Rayleigh. And she, you know, she's there to help this guy because he's so confused. He doesn't know what time it is. He says that he's from the future. And so when somebody says they're on the future or they're Jesus Christ, they send for her.
Hasn't she ever seen a movie before? Like, usually when someone says they're from the future, they're right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what
every movie ever made.
Yeah, that's why I believe all those guys on YouTube that are telling us what's up. I got to say, I love Madeline Stowe.
She's great.
She is great.
I haven't seen her in much else.
I looked her up because I didn't recognize her from anything else.
What?
Because the blonde or?
That's okay, right. Yeah. Changed her hair color. It's so tricky.
She was in Stakeout and Shortcuts.
Yeah.
And what was the movie right before this? Was it like Blink or
I don't know.
She was in some thriller. She's great. I don't know if she has like a fervent enough fan base for this, but if she has like a fan base like Jimmy Buffett has the parrot heads, they should call them stowaways.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. I like it.
That's yeah. I don't know.
I don't know if she's that popular, but she's great.
I think we all just became stowaways. I think she's great in this movie.
Yeah. But she doesn't believe him, obviously, and he gets committed to a mental institution. Mm-hmm. And it's there that he meets this guy named Jeffrey Goines, played by the aforementioned sexiest man alive, Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like a 9.5 out of 10 at this point because, you know, he's wiry. He's like being really twitchy and manic. He's got like tufts of his hair pulled out. Mm-hmm. But he shows Bruce Willis around the place, sort of gives him the setup, all while ranting about like consumerism and the environment and all that stuff, sounding like a real crazy person or somebody who has a handle on what is happening in the world.
It is weird to see the guy who was just on the cover of People magazine for being the sexiest man alive, like ranting about the problems of consumerism.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I just paid $5.99 for that magazine you were on. Now you're telling me I'm an asshole for it?
But wow. You are so right. Like when I was watching it, everything he's saying we've since come to know to be true. Like everything. It's so sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he needs to get out of this insane asylum. And so
– is that the right – I don't think that's the right term.
I mean,
today.
It's not the right term. Neither is mental institution.
Well, this
wouldn't be considered like a good place.
No, I think the right term is probably like mental health facility. But this is basically a dungeon in which they've thrown all these people.
That's why we can call it like the nut house, because it's like this imagination of what that would be like.
Yeah. And it's also like a very like Terry Gilliam-esque sort of situation. So it's not just that, like, well, and to like give him a little bit of credit, I do think that there is like a lot of humanity in the way that he portrays the people there, but at the same time, they are like kind of like, you know, stock caricatures.
It's a condition of mental divergence. I find myself on the planet Ogo, part of an intellectual elite, preparing to subjugate the barbarian hordes on Pluto. But even though this is a totally convincing reality for me in every way, nevertheless, Ogo is actually a construct of my psyche. I am mentally divergent in that I am escaping certain unnamed realities.
They are, but I also think, like, as kind of cartoonish as it is, I think the way he films it and the way it's portrayed is meant to, like, for us, the audience members, to feel the kind of the burden and the mishandling of these patients.
For sure.
Totally.
So, I don't think it's as dated as you might initially suspect.
No, and it really reminded me of that scene in The Fisher King, too, where they're in the hospital and everyone's trying to get attention and trying to get helped and no one is getting helped.
Yeah.
It's canted angles. You feel for the people. You're like, oh, you shouldn't be here. You should be being helped in some way.
And even the Brad Pitt character, who's like, you know, in the movie, quote unquote, crazy, is like you said, making valid points about about the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, he might have some mental health struggles, but that doesn't discount what he has to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like the people that they have playing the they're kind of captors, quote unquote.
Yeah, the orderlies.
Have the most like anger management issues out of anyone in that ward.
Well, that's also like a kind of a cliche.
Yeah.
You know,
the Nurse Ratched thing.
Yeah, or yeah. But yeah, but so he, Brad Pitt helps him attempt to escape, but he gets recaptured and he's sort of put into this cell, but he disappears.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Straight through the walls.
Straight through the walls. And the Riddler can't even figure out where he went. Frank Gorshin.
That's pretty good.
He plays the doctor.
You know, I didn't know if you guys – I put that as one of the trivia things for later. I didn't know if you guys would recognize him.
Oh, I didn't recognize him at all. That's great.
Which is funny that it's the Riddler because – in the scenes that he's in the hospital, or not necessarily the ones he's in, but in the hospital he's overseeing, is shot entirely with canted angles, like the Batman show.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's creepy.
I have a Frank Gorshin story. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I met Frank Gorshin.
Good story.
Good. Thanks. Let's move on.
Well, no, it's a slightly longer story. I love the
Batman. You're institutionalized.
Guys, this JM.
I'm from the future. 1996. I was a big fan of the Batman show, and as a kid, I went to go see Frank Gorshin. He's dead now, but he did a stand-up show at Yuck Yucks in Toronto, and it was like a straight – because he was a comedian before he got the Batman gig.
Right.
And he just came in and did like literally his act from like 1964. It was – a very old school.
What's the deal with Albert Schweitzer?
No, well, he's an impressionist, so he's doing his impressions, but they're all like, you know, Kirk Douglas.
This one's and Albert Schweitzer.
No, Burt Lancaster and all these guys. And it was like, it was great. He was amazing. And it was just, you know, it was this kind of just perfectly imported from the 1960s act.
Wow.
The kind of thing you'd probably see in the Vegas Strip, you know, smoking and drinking copiously. But that was great. I didn't get to meet him then. But then years later, I went to this like kind of like nostalgia show. Before like Comic-Cons were so big, they probably still have these kinds of things. But it was like a nostalgia show where people went in and they sold comic books and old toys and stuff. Mm. And it was literally in an elementary school gym, also in Toronto. Very sad, very depressing, not crowded. Yeah. And the special guest was Frank Gorshin. And he sat up there on this on the little stage where, you know, most days of the week the principal of the elementary school is telling kids not to poop in the hallways or whatever.
I have a way I want this story to end, and I really hope it ends.
Well, it was really depressing, and I went up there, and Frank Gorshin, I don't even think he was like looking us in the eyes. He just had 8x10s of the Riddler and 8x10s of his appearance on Star Trek. Mm. And he was like, "Oh, what she wants, Star Trek or the Riddler?" And you know, he's just signing it for people. I don't even think there was a lineup to meet him. And we met him, and I was with my dad, and we said, "You know, we went and we saw you do stand up, you know, 5 years ago or whatever it was." And he looked up and you could tell he just lit up completely.
Mm.
He was like, "Oh, really? Like, what did you think?" Like he came to life when he was talking about stand up and was so, I think, touched that we had been fans of his comedy and just didn't want to sign an 8x10 of whoever that alien from Star Trek was.
So, you like me for me?
Yeah. But he seemed like a sweet man.
That's good.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say that he just did the same act again. like verbatim.
No.
That's the only thing he's ever done in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
Yeah,
he's great in this. So then he's back in the future. Mm-hmm. And they're not exactly happy with his performance. So,
because he didn't call in, he didn't leave a message on this like answering machine that he was supposed to leave a message on.
Well, they think that he did leave a message.
Yeah.
It's just that it's taken him a long time to put it back together. So they play him this message, this strange message.
Yeah.
And he decides to convince them to like send him back.
Right.
So they do. They put him in like the little tube and
squeeze him out.
They squeeze him into the past. And they say that it's going to be more accurate this time, but immediately after they say that, he shows up in World War I.
Yeah, it's kind of like a real funny joke in the middle of this movie for no reason.
Yeah.
I kind of love that, like, well, for one thing, I wouldn't trust anyone to like send me to the past, especially not like some weird shambolic future government.
Yeah.
Sure.
But also, you imagine, like, because it's not set in that far away a future. It's set in 2035. The resources are somewhat diminished. So, like, of course their time travel would be sloppy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love that they keep sending him to the wrong time.
Me too. I like that. Yeah, so he's there briefly, and then he disappears. And then the next thing we see is Madeline Stowe, Catherine, she's giving a lecture about prophecies and the Cassandra effect, which is the thing where you tell the future and nobody believes you, right?
Yeah.
And she talks about this guy in World War One who, it turns out, is Bruce Willis.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. And she even gets a visit from David Morse, who comes to see her after her talk. Mm-hmm. But immediately after that, she's kidnapped.
Yeah. She had a big fan of hers in the back seat.
A stowaway. One of her stowaways got too enthusiastic and pretends to have a gun and kidnaps her. And this, is James Cole, is the Bruce Willis character. And she recognizes him from before. And I should also mention that she says that she thought he was familiar the first time that that she saw him.
Right. He remembers him from something, but not sure where.
Yeah.
It was probably Die Hard with a Vengeance, which came out just a few months before
that. You're Bruce Willis?
Yeah, Bruce Willis was going through a tough time. He didn't know he was making a movie. But yeah, he kidnaps her and he forces her to like drive, I think, to Philadelphia, right? Mm.
Yeah, because he's trying to track down the 12 monkeys.
Yeah. And all the while, like,
did we even mention the 12 monkeys yet?
No.
That seems like an oversight in a movie called 12 Monkeys.
I mean, we don't know quite what the 12 Monkeys thing is, like, at first.
But he sees the sign in that first scene, no?
That's right. And he says, there's a spray-painted picture of the red monkey and a sign that says, "We did it."
Mm-hmm.
And so he wants to
see, if you watch that movie now, you'd just be like, oh, it's probably a Banksy. It's probably not a clue. Yeah,
that's a piece of art.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an advertisement. But he's sent back with the explicit mission from the message that they made him listen to, that he's supposed to find out where the 12 monkeys are and stop the sort of thing from happening.
Right.
That's his mission.
Yeah, so that's why he's going to Philadelphia to track them down.
That's right.
And he discovers that, like, Brad Pitt is the leader of the 12 monkeys, right?
That's what he discovers
pretty fast.
And even that he gave him the idea for wiping out humanity when he was like – he was talking about things. He was watching TV and he says, you know, maybe mankind deserves to be wiped out.
Right.
And then Brad Pitt's like, that's a great idea.
I only get my ideas from Bruce Willis's. Thank you so much for this.
I just want access to the pure virus.
Virus?
Yes, for the future. I need to know where it is and exactly what it is.
Ah, I get it. I see what you're up to. It's your old plan, isn't it?
What plan? Your plan? What are you talking about? What plan?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. We were in the day room watching television, and you were all upset about the desecration of the planet, which I understand. But then you said to me, wouldn't it be great if there was a germ or a virus that would wipe out all of mankind, like the animals and the trees? That
was no, so you're just trying to confuse me.
So funny. And I told you my father was this famous virologist, and you said, hey, he can make a germ, and we can steal it.
Well, there's also this weird scene I wanted to get your guys' opinion of when, after he kidnaps Madeline Stowe, after they figure out that Jeffrey is behind the 12 monkeys, they go to his dad's mansion where he's having a party, played by previous sexiest man alive, Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, 1994.
And he's a
I don't know if he was the sexiest man. He's the sexiest man in our hearts.
Yeah, oh, for sure. But and he plays like this top virologist around the world, right? He's like working with viruses. So he's probably in on this whole end of the world thing.
Yeah, we see all the pieces coming together.
Yeah.
And they go to find him, and there's this kind of – there's this weird edit where Bruce Willis is basically attacking Madeline Stowe. And I looked it up. A lot of – or at least a few places got – even reviews at the time thought that it was implied that he sexually assaulted her in that moment.
Yeah.
Because he says like, oh, you smell so good, and then basically grabs her, and then it cuts – to the mansion.
Well, I think we're meant to think that he murdered her or did something horrible to her. And then, you know, when he comes – because there's even in the house –
I mean, you put her in the trunk. It's pretty horrible.
Yeah. Time out. But he puts it in the truck. But, like, we don't know that. We think something maybe horrible happened to her. And then we see the news thing in the kitchen where someone over the news is saying that maybe the body, potentially the body of her, Madeline Stowe, was found in a park. So we're like, oh, he murdered her. He is crazy. I think that's what it's supposed to be. So when he opens the trunk, we're supposed to be like, oh, he didn't do anything to her. He just put her in the trunk, like, because all of that was fake.
It's so weird because I don't think that that character would – murder that woman for a second. Like,
no.
That would be such, like, you know, that would be such a left field play.
Yeah. I also, I don't think we're meant to believe that he would force himself on her either, like, through what we know of his character and what we the signs we've been given.
I would hope
it's surprising
so.
That Terry Gilliam doesn't
yeah.
You know the difference.
Maybe we should address the elephant running wild through the streets. Terry Gilliam is has kind of been putting his foot in his mouth lately interviews. I don't remember exactly what he said. He called Me Too a witch hunt and
yeah.
was kind of making fun of like identity politics in an awkward old man way.
Yeah. It's disappointing, obviously, because I do think he's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time.
Right.
And also because of his connection to Monty Python, you know.
Yeah.
I have so many, like, you know, great, beloved memories.
So you want him on the right side of history.
I want him on the right side of history. Yeah. And there are lots of cranks in Monty Python. John Cleese is kind of a crank. Eric Idle's kind of a greedy old crank. Mm-hmm. Michael Palin's nice. Yeah, but
I met him too.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Actually, I met Terry Gilliam, and he was lovely, but doesn't excuse the things he said, obviously.
Me too is bullcrap.
What are you talking about? It's 2003. Yeah. Why are you saying that?
I've come from the future to tell you.
Right. Yeah.
God damn it.
It's just, it sucks. It's really disappointing. And I mean, you know, like Terry Gilliam also. I think because of his acerbic nature, like he's the guy who, you know, he fought the studios with Brazil. He was like fighting to get his movies made and to do it his way and to like, you know, make films that were imaginative and surreal and like not formulaic. And it sucks because, A, the movies he's made since, you know, recently haven't been great. And B, he's a dick.
I remember when the time I met him was at a screening of Brazil. And the singer from Metric was sitting behind me. And during the Q&A portion, she asked, like, oh, it's such a bold movie. Like, did the studio not have any problem with it? And everyone kind of laughed. And he was like, oh, do you not know this story? And she's like, no. So he was like, oh, okay. So, and then he kind of went into the whole thing. Because, I mean, there have been, like, books written about the various cuts and notes he had to deal with on that movie.
Well, yeah, some of the behind the scenes of this movie is that he was so afraid to work with Universal again because of Brazil.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had to, like, so many people had to sign so many pieces of paper to give him final cut on this movie.
Yeah. Which is kind of amazing that it happened at all.
Definitely.
Based on that crazy thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, thankfully, it's sort of perfect material for him. And it's really great. You know, this is one of the things. Does he usually write his own scripts? I can't remember.
He did up until The Fisher King.
Yeah.
That was the first thing he directed that he hadn't written.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is like just such a perfect fit for his material. And there's not too much Terry Gilliam-esque-ness in it, but just like the right amount.
Yeah.
For sure.
But that said, it doesn't make it easy watching the parts with women because I just don't think he's great with women. You know, even in this, even though Madeline Stowe is so great, there is sometimes like the sense like she is like an object to be won or something like, you know, like, yeah, like Bruce
like
Willis
point.
Is going to like kiss her, you know, or they're going to get together at some point.
Yeah, for sure. But I think Madeline Stowe kind of shines through all that. She's kind of the eye of this hurricane of madness in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like whenever she's on screen, I can take a little breather and enjoy the movie sometimes.
Yeah.
Hashtag Stowaway.
Yeah. But all through this, there's been like a media thing happening, a media event. It is little Timmy, I think his name is, mm-hmm. has been stuck in a well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a big thing. We sort of follow it from moment to moment. And Bruce Willis's character, he even like, you know, refers to it. And he tells Madeline Stowe that in the end, it's a prank, that the boy was hiding in a barn mm-hmm. and that he was safe the whole time.
Right.
And she doesn't believe it. until after the kidnapping ordeal is over, after they've gone to see the FAA, which is the precursor group to the 12 Monkeys, and found out about Jeffrey Goins' attachment to it and all of that stuff. She is – so much stuff happens, but she is free, and she's, like, talking to her friends, and they're like – oh, yeah, they found that boy. He was hiding in a barn. It was a prank the whole time. And so this is really interesting because up until this point, she hasn't believed him about the time travel. And he has slowly been accepting the point that, like, the guy in the asylum tells him – not the asylum, the mental health facility – tells him that he is having a divergent experience, right. That he very succinctly and eloquently talks about his problems, that he sort of believes this, but it's a problem. And, you know, until he gets himself right, he'll still have these hallucinations or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so Bruce Willis's character, Cole, hasn't bought into this, but he's slowly starting to. And, you know, after, like, being sent back, I mean, all he wants is to be in this place, which is, like, normalcy, which he is starting to believe is the place that is not a hallucination. Mm-hmm. He flips. And so he thinks that he's having a divergent experience. Yeah. And she is saying, no, you were right.
Yeah.
You were right about the future. It is all going to end if we don't do something.
Because the kind of the final nail in the coffin, too, is that cook from Wet Hot American Summer phones her up and is like, oh, we found this bullet from the First World War. And
oh, yeah, that's
Christopher
right.
Maloney.
Yeah, Stabler. Stabler does some of his classic victim empathy.
Oh, right.
Special victim.
Yes.
The other thing the movie does really cleverly, I think, is not only does Bruce Willis start to doubt the reality of the future, but the movie, the way it depicts the future becomes very surreal. So even as an audience member, you kind of start to doubt its reality.
Yeah, I read that's what Terry Gilliam wanted to do, was to be like, this could be a time travel story or this could be a story about mental illness. Like, it could be either one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is not true, because
as long
everything
as you ignore
happens,
the photograph from World War I.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And everything that happens from then
well,
on out.
No, but there are, like, you know, every once in a while you see a photograph or a painting that looks like exactly like somebody.
That's
like,
true. That
was like Greta Thunberg.
Nicolas Cage.
Keanu Reeves.
There's a painting of, like, you know, Isaac sacrificing his son that looks exactly like my brother Kenny. Mm. And his neck's being cut.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Whenever you, like, were angry at him, did you slip that picture under his door?
I just start painting. Yeah, but I mean, the future as they depict it is really strange. Like, there's this, like, panel of doctor scientists. There's, like, this weird, like, media ball thing with all these screens on it. Mm-hmm. The time travel device is, like, a see-through tube.
You laugh, but in 15 years, we're all going to be watching media balls. It's going to be how we consume entertainment.
Well, yeah.
So we should probably, like, get to the ending, because the ending's the big thing. When we finally get to this, well, they go to the movies.
Yeah,
they go to dyes her hair because she's out in 18 Hitchcock movies.
That's right. And yeah, they're going to go to the airport to stop.
Yeah, Brad Pitt.
And while he's there, Cole realizes that this dream that he's been having, that we've been seeing throughout the movie, of the guy being shot in the airport, he realizes that this is the moment, that it's not a dream, that it's a memory.
Yeah.
And
that's a great realization. I love that kind of flip.
I know this place.
Airports all look the same.
This is my dream.
Oh. Your mustache.
It's not just my dream. I was actually here. Remember now, about a week or two before everyone started dying.
Careful. They might be looking for us.
I was here.
They've also figured out that Brad Pitt was not the source of the toxin, because while they're in the taxi to the airport, the taxi driver tells them that the people who released all the animals were the 12 monkeys, and that's what they were referring to with the "we did it."
So the taxi driver is like the short woman with a beret, and I just wanted to know so much about her.
Yeah, she's amazing.
I want a whole spin-off movie just about her.
That's not what the Amazon series is about. Yeah, but yeah, so they really should have been more specific with that street art.
Yeah.
What did they do?
Yeah. We released the animals, yeah. Not this other thing. Or any it. Other things.
And by it, we mean, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so Bruce Willis gets shot in front of himself. Madeline Stowe realizes that, like, oh.
They realize that it's.
It was David Morris is the. Yeah. The creepy virus guy.
Yeah, because he works with Christopher Plummer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and he's releasing the virus. And yeah, and it all happens, like, just like happens exactly like in his memory. He's running, he has the gun, he tries to, gets prepared to shoot, and then he gets shot and he dies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of the movie.
Well, and then there's the scene with the woman from the future. What's her name? Jones, she says.
That's right.
And she sits next to David Morris. Because you kind of realize that that they can't change anything about the future. That is all kind of set in stone. And the only thing they can do is learn as much about the virus as possible.
Well, they were trying to get a sample of the virus.
Yeah.
Which is why they're like he's eating bugs and stuff to take them back to the future. To try to get some of that sample of the virus.
Right.
And so
yeah, yeah, so she says she's talking to the guy and she says she works in insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Now, some people I went online, some people think this is a coincidence, that this is like irony of all ironies. She was beside this guy the whole
yeah.
time, and that in the future she should have realized that she was beside this guy in
wait,
the plane.
What?
Yeah. Some people think that. And then other people think, no, she was also returned to the past after they got all this information, and she's there to get infected to take it back to the future to, like, because everyone's immune in the future, so she can at least get it, the first strain, and then they can synthesize like an antidote.
That's what
to return.
I assumed. Or yeah. she could just pick his brain and be like, hey, how exactly does that virus work? Or kidnap right. him and bring him back to the future and
oh
torture
my God.
Him until
yeah.
he's
yeah.
secure.
Yeah. I was a bit confused about that. Like, I didn't know whether, like, because they send Bruce Willis to kill him. So
yeah.
I thought maybe when she was saying that she's insurance, that she was going to commit the killing herself, but then the virus wouldn't spread the same way.
Wait, they don't send Bruce Willis to kill him, do they? But that guy gives him a gun.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they do kind of.
But I kind of read that as almost like they know that he has to die.
Future, yeah.
So that's.
But he doesn't have to die unless they
yeah.
make him die.
It's so interesting. I've been reading up on like time travel theories and stuff, and people think that if, you know, we went back and changed something, it would kind of ricochet back and forth, like recursively, until
right.
it kind of went back to normal. Like there would be echoes of the things we changed, but less and less until it like kind of returned to normalcy after all. So
right.
you could never really change. You could think you changed the future, but you never really would. So this kind of feels like it's in one of those bounce back moments where like – they kind of changed the future, but it's normalizing again. Like they couldn't fully change
it. It's like
it.
When you pluck the string on a guitar.
Right, the reverberation.
String theory.
We're so high right now, guys. Sorry.
Guitar, harmonica, the return of Bruno. All fits.
It works. It works.
Okay, we're going to be right back after a few messages. We're going to have some trivia, some behind-the-scenes stuff. Stick around.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're back on Rewatchability. We're talking about 12 Monkeys.
Sorry, did we disinfect these microphones?
Oh, my God.
we definitely did not. Just immediately dies.
That's, you know, that's why Steven Tyler has all those rags on his microphone. He's constantly wiping them for germs.
God.
Okay, so we have some behind-the-scenes stuff. Blaine, you and I both prepared some trivia questions.
Yeah.
Why don't you go first with some?
So let's let Rob do it. No, I have some questions.
Okay.
You guys are so much more clever than me when it comes to movies, so you'll answer these pretty easily. There are two movies where Bruce Willis, might have already read this, travels back in time and meets a younger version of himself. What are those movies?
Oh, come on.
Well, I had a sort of different variation of the same question.
Oh, great. Okay. What was yours?
Mine is there are, excluding this movie, there are three movies where Bruce Willis interacts with his past self.
Okay.
Can you name those three movies?
Oh, my God.
Okay. One of them is for sure Looper.
Yes.
Yes.
And then another one is for sure The Kid.
Disney's The Kid.
Disney's The Kid.
I can't think of the third one.
This one's kind of a trick.
Okay.
I mean, it's partly a trick because no one saw this movie because it's dumb. But it's not a time travel movie.
Okay.
If that helps.
So how does he interact with himself in the past if it's not time travel?
It is a movie called Surrogates.
Oh.
In which he has like a robot version of his younger self.
I've seen that.
I made someone else watch that for me.
I think I've seen it.
What?
As a surrogate.
Oh.
God, I remember
God
that.
God damn it, guys.
Yeah, it's not a great movie.
No.
Okay. Yeah, that was like cool. That was like some very early de-aging technology.
Oh,
yeah.
It
was rough.
It was not great.
Scorsese is like, not ready yet.
I will improve that by 4%.
Okay. So the song Blueberry Hill is in this movie. Mm-hmm. Scientists sing it in this movie also. Mm-hmm. And it was written in 1940, but is best remembered for its version by Fats Domino, released in 1956. But what world-famous person revitalized his popularity in 2010?
I didn't know that happened.
Wait, what?
There's a person that we all know the full name of, very famous person, that sang this.
Blueberry Hill.
Blueberry Hill, in front of a bunch of other famous people. And it became like a meme, and it went viral.
It became a meme, and it's a person with three names.
Well, no, two names.
Was it like Obama or something?
Oh, that's close. Was politician.
Stephen Harper?
No. What,
Donald Trump?
Even closer, because it was Vladimir Putin.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. The funniest thing, watching the video, maybe we'll put it up on Facebook or something. Watch it's – first of all –
Lyrics are changed because it's like, this person lost my thrill and he will be disappeared.
Yeah, exactly. When you find all of us suicided with one bullet in the back of our heads.
Blueberry Hill is the name of a gulag.
Yeah. Getting his kicks. Yeah, no, he sang it. It's not great. There's like an echo effect on his voice. I think someone else is singing behind him.
Of course. Yeah.
And then it pans from him singing it like he's not enjoying himself at all, like stone-faced, to Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn both laughing and clapping along. It's like the weirdest fucking thing.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It wasn't just for him. It was a fundraiser for ill children, which is probably why those celebrities were there. But it just makes me feel weird. Yeah.
By the way,
like
if no new rewatchability comes on your feed next week, it's because
they slipped polonium in our coffees.
Do you have another question?
I do. So Brad Pitt was nominated for his role in this film for Best Supporting Actor. He lost to Kevin Spacey in Usual Suspects. That didn't age well, Academy. It didn't age well. Brad Pitt has since been nominated 5 times for an Academy Award, and he's won twice. What were his 2 wins for?
Well, I do know this.
Yeah, because
he won this
year.
Yes. He won literally weeks ago.
Best Supporting Actor, yep, for Once Upon a Time.
And
his abs, I think.
The other time he won, I believe, was as a producer, right?
It was.
For 12 Years a Slave.
Yes.
Oh.
That's the times he was nominated, too, for The Big Short, I think, as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That was a movie which he produced and gave himself a role in as the one nice white guy. Like, I'll be the one guy that, like, helps free Solomon.
Dude, I'm not casting myself as a slave owner. That shit will stick with me. I want to be sexiest man alive again.
Yeah, that's what you can do if you're a producer.
Right.
There you go.
I have one other question
please,
that we haven't covered.
Okay.
And that is an actor from the last movie we talked about, Last Action Hero.
Okay.
Someone in that movie appears in the 12 Monkeys TV show.
Who?
Do you know who that is?
Arnold fucking Schwarzenegger.
No.
Okay. Damn. I was wrong strong,
I'm
right?
I'm going to say Mercedes Rule.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
It is. You're done guessing?
Yeah.
Austin O'Brien?
Tom Noonan.
Oh, Tom Noonan.
You got Noonan. That's good.
He plays some kind of shadowy character. I haven't seen it.
That's a long shadow.
I watched the first episode once.
Yeah,
and
me too.
I hear it gets really good, but the first episode is kind of just a glossier, handsomer, not handsomer because Brad Pitt's in this, I guess, but like everyone looks more bathed than they do in the movie, but it's essentially the same story in that first episode.
Yeah. But it has like the same characters, like there's a James Cole and a Jeffrey Goines.
Yeah, I don't know if they have the same names.
They changed the name of Madeline Stowe's character to Cassandra because they really wanted to hit that theme. A little bit more.
I also realized Brad Pitt's character is a woman, I think, right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I can't remember it. I watched the pilot so long ago and then watched half the second episode and was like, nope.
Yeah. It was filmed here in Toronto.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
His name is James Cole.
I should give it another go. Mm. But I was just – the Cassandra thing is about saying what is happening, people not believing you, or what will happen, people not believing you. Whereas like – The Boy in the Well is kind of the opposite of that. It's saying what did happen and a lot of people believing them, but it's not true.
Well, yeah. And
that's really interesting.
That's like the same thing as the movie where like everybody thinks that the Red Monkeys – or sorry, the 12 Monkeys.
Everyone to go to your website.
Jesus. It's redmonkey.angelfire.tripod.com.
If you don't like it.
Oh, you've been on my website. You must be one of the visitors on the counter. You must be 102. Well, yeah, everybody thinks that the 12 monkeys are the ones who released the plague, but it wasn't the 12 monkeys. It was this other guy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. I mean, in terms of misinformation. Also, I've been thinking a lot about misinformation because of this whole thing that's happening with the coronavirus. And then I also just watched Chernobyl.
Okay, yeah.
Chernobyl?
Chernobyl? Yeah.
It's the documentary about the singer.
It's about, yeah.
It's about how
Noble Cher.
Yeah.
She had a big meltdown.
Yeah, anyway, it's scary. Scary times. Do you believe in life after love, after the apocalypse?
Did you guys ever watch La Jetée, the film upon which this is based?
No. Didn't it come with the special edition of 12 Monkeys?
No.
I thought it did.
Yeah, I thought it
maybe
did.
Maybe like a recent one, but like not back in the day.
Not back in the day. But yeah, like the special collector's edition I think it came with. And
I'm just a regular collector. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd never
remember.
Seen it.
It's still photographs.
Mainly still photographs.
And it's like what? It's like 20 minutes long?
There's like one part with movement. Right. It's about half an hour.
Yeah.
It's great. I remember like when because I obviously hadn't seen it before this, and I don't think it was commercially available here. So I remember trying to go to like a screening of it at the Cinematheque and it was sold out. And I didn't get to see it till I actually went to film school and they had it in the library, I think, on film. So I borrowed it and got to watch it. It was very exciting that I finally got to watch La Jetée. And then over the course of film school, I probably watched it 20 goddamn times because so many so many classes showed it. But I was initially very excited to watch it. And I was going to try to watch it because I have there's a Criterion Blu-ray of it now with San Saleh. I was going to try to watch it again, and of course I didn't have time. But it's a great movie.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is it's very simple story about like this guy who has seen his own death basically because of this time travel plot. And I love how this movie just kind of builds on that very simple premise and makes it its own thing. I looked up to see what Chris Marker, the director, thought of 12 Monkeys because I didn't know if he was like shitty about it or if he liked it. And he said he thought it was a magnificent film. And he thought it was just kind of its own movie. And he respected Terry Gilliam. So
Well, I think it's good that they, the reference to La Jetée is not minimized in any way. Like this movie, I feel like in all the sort of talk about it, it's like, yes, this is a adaptation, remake, is inspired by La Jetée, and, even though it's its own thing.
Right. It's interestingly inspired by because the Writers Guild was saying that was kind of a problem for them. It's something that they tripped over because I think you don't have to pay someone a lot of money if you say inspired by.
Right.
But I think if it's this based the first
on.
Time
yeah, I think it might have been the first time they did that. But they got David and Janet Peoples to write this script, like a husband wife power duo, screenwriters who had been nominated for Academy Award for documentaries.
I think they won it.
Yeah, they probably,
And he wrote Blade Runner.
Yeah.
He wrote Blade Runner and Lady Hawk.
Yeah.
Which is just better than Blade Runner, from what I remember.
It's got more Rutger Hauer.
There you go.
Yeah.
And Unforgiven.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so very, very strong writers, those two people. And they it shows.
And they said they basically got hired to do this movie. It was like a producer really wanted to remake La Jetée, and they didn't want to do it because, like I said, the short film is basically a perfect movie. But apparently, David Peoples said in an interview, him and his wife, we say to each other, well, if they kidnapped our children and we had to write this in order to get our children back, what would we do? That's how they came up with the story for 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
I'm going to think of that next time I have a writing assignment or something.
But it's the same reason why – what's his name? He always writes – Damon Lindelof did Watchmen, right? Because he – said he
children were kidnapped
but he loves it in a way because the Watchmen was his childhood, was the way he connected to his dad and what got him into the business in the first place, and to watch it fall into someone else's hands who might do it worse, might harm his
you can say his name Zack Snyder.
Oh god, yeah, then you know that gave him pain. So it's almost like his children were kidnapped and he was writing to get them back, because it's, you know, for them, if it's a perfect movie for them, if they love La Jetée, then giving it to someone, like, it's probably going to be made anyway.
It was an assignment. They just didn't want to, like, you know, do a worse movie.
True. But they probably didn't want anyone else to fuck it up either. So, and it was in good hands. They're great writers.
Yeah.
And it shows. This movie was great. And even the original writer-director of La Jetée liked it.
Yeah.
So and it all worked out.
Brad Pitt, like you said, was Oscar nominated for this. Mm-hmm. I remember at the time, like, people that were like a little older than me, maybe it was people I read or you know, older siblings of friends kind of thing, were kind of wrote him off as being just an impression of Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now.
What? Right.
Which I didn't get because I didn't see that movie till a few years later.
Sure.
But I looked it up and he basically admitted it. He said when he was making this movie, he locked himself in an apartment to try and get in the headspace of the character and just kind of focus on doing the work of figuring out what his performance would look like. And he said part of it was he was watching anything from Dennis Hopper, trying to find the voice of the movie.
Well, that's cool.
So
it works.
He straight up admitted he was doing a Dennis Hopper thing. Yeah. I think it works.
Yeah. Also, I mean, he's amazing, I think, in this movie. And like even like his eyes doing something weird when he's in the mental institution.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know how they did that. I don't know whether it's just like something that he did, that he has control over one eye.
It's
weird. Move them independently, but that was pretty cool.
Yeah, but he's like totally committed to the role.
And a lot of people took pay cuts on this movie to make this movie because they just wanted to work with Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
Which shows you how things have changed, because I'm sure people are less less likely to take a pay cut and more a raise to work with him now.
But, well, I mean, his most recent movie had Adam Driver.
Yeah.
Who's, you know, he's like one of the most beloved actors working.
Yeah, but he's also in everything. I don't think he knows how to say no. You know, Terry, I'm pretty busy. I got Marriage Story and Star Wars. It'll only take 9 months.
I am a famous art house director. You must do what I say.
I'll scream. I'll throw a tantrum.
And the alternate casting, because Terry Gilliam wanted Jeff Bridges because he just worked with him in Fisher King. So he wanted him to play the Bruce Willis role. And they were like, nah, we don't want Jeff Bridges. We want a bigger name that'll attract people to watch this movie. So he went for Bruce Willis, who had auditioned for Jeff Bridges' role in The Fisher King.
Oh.
And he went with Jeff Bridges then. But I find it weird because then the studio is like, oh, you only get this much money and you have to kind of convince Bruce Willis to do it for nothing. And so Terry Gilliam had to go to Bruce Willis and be like, you're the only one that can do this. And then a week later be like, take a massive pay cut.
I love the return of Bruno.
Yeah, exactly. So Bruce Willis said that he would not get paid until it came out in theaters.
Nice. Ooh, yeah. I mean, he's great in this as well. I really love his performance.
He's so solid.
Playing damaged and vulnerable. Yeah. And, like, he really sort of conveys, I think, what the feeling of being in a different time would be. Like, he's so confused.
Yeah, the scene where he hears the radio, the song on the radio, Blueberry Hill,
yeah,
like, and gets emotional. He's great.
Oh, man, the tears welling.
I think it's great. I read that Gilliam gave him the part because he saw the scene in Die Hard where he's taking out the glass from his feet while talking about his wife.
Yeah, and he was like, that's a great scene. Good writing in that scene. He's like, oh, I ad-libbed it. He's like, oh, you're the man for me.
I did it all. I directed it too. How did you direct? You're like Hans, I played him.
I'll say whatever you want me to
say. I know you didn't do that. You know, I totally forgot about this until you were talking about casting. I remember, like, when I rented the DVD, probably the last time I watched this years ago, there is a feature-length doc about the making of this movie. And I remember, I don't remember much from that, but I do remember at one point when they're shooting the airport scene, like the big pivotal scene in the movie, he fires the kid actor.
Yes, I remember that too.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like,
oh, he's not working out.
Yeah, he wasn't like, it wasn't that the kid was bad. It was just like they got on set and he was, Terry Gilliam was just placed like, he doesn't have the right look.
Right.
And it was...
Apparently he like kind of clammed up because he was a kid on major movie set for the first time too.
It seemed like he was like pretty sensitive about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I do know, like, you know, Sarah Pauly famously called him out for not having a good time on the Baron Munchausen set.
Right.
But it did seem like he kind of went up to the kid and was like, it's nothing you're doing, but it's just like, you know, I just have a different vision for this. We just need to go another way. And then, yeah, like the crew had to be like, bring in the other kid.
Yeah. He had another kid in the background.
Another kid.
Yeah. The same day he had another kid.
So, but I remember that being like a really awkward, imagine like being on the set of the movie and being a little kid.
I wonder where that kid is now.
I don't know.
Probably watched himself die.
What?
I don't know.
Like in the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. That seemed really like morose otherwise, a little morbid.
If we're talking about the, you know, rewatching it now versus when we watched it as kids, one of the biggest and most obvious things about the movie now is the very heavy-handed Jesus-y implications of the movie.
Oh.
Because Cole's initials are JC.
Mm-hmm. That's
always a tip off. And his whole story is about having this kind of like predetermined death,
right,
that he does to sacrifice himself for the good of humanity.
Yeah. And also like the soapbox thing of like every crazy person throughout time that has been like, hey, the end is coming, has been a time traveler that just didn't work out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Is what they're kind of saying in this movie.
Yeah. And also even just like the idea of like, you know, humanity and the apocalypse being kind of visited upon humanity because of our sins. Like they do kind of.
Right.
Do kind of emphasize that we're not just getting this virus for no reason. It's because of all the things multiple characters espouse in the movie. And especially the way the environment is being treated, which is more relevant now than even it was back in 95, sadly.
Will continue to be more relevant forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're even saying like they really, they underscore the apocalypse stuff with like Madeline Stowe mentions Book of Revelation and everything in her lecture and people point to the end where the Christmas decorations basically solidify the fact that the future is not going to change, and that's visualized in the form of that angel being raised into place in the department store, which is like an angel of doom and apocalypse. And
yeah, but the angel was kind of strapped into this backboard. They were lifting it up by straps, and I think the eyes were shut, like covered by that strap.
It reminds me of that Walter Benjamin essay. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Oh, no.
The Angel of History or something like that. He only sees backwards at his destruction.
Oh, that's
interesting. It's really interesting.
That's really cool.
I don't know. I read about it in grad school.
Yeah. It sounds like a grad school thing to read about.
And also 12 monkeys, 12 apostles.
Yeah.
Oh.
For sure. For sure.
I don't know. I think there's something there. I just say
Madeline Stowe's like Mary Magdalene.
Someone did say that. There's no one source to credit because I saw multiple people talking about.
I mean, once you say maybe it's Jesus, you can just like, you know, you can read anything into it, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, those parallels definitely work.
Was there like a Bible story where Jesus ripped out people's teeth?
John 4:21.
4:20.
Jesus got baked on some bad shit. I don't know. Maybe it was like dipped in formaldehyde. I don't know.
And while we're talking about symbolism in the movie. I did see someone pointed out online that the beds in the hospital where they sleep are kind of arranged in a circle like the 12 Monkeys logo.
Hmm.
Thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is a bit interesting.
Or a clock.
But only a bit.
Did you have any other behind-the-scenes stuff?
There was a lawsuit.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. Lebeus Woods, which, first of all, fucking great name.
Yeah.
That's a prime name. He sued over that chair and orb that was in the movie.
Right.
Because it was kind of it's my orb. Give me the orb. From one of his pieces called Neo Mechanical Opportunity. I don't know. It's from that seminal work that everyone knows about. And he won.
It'd be almost insulting for you to name exactly what it's called.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I don't want to.
We're all so familiar.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, you could go ahead and...
I don't want to get sued. So he won the lawsuit, and the next step for the studio was to take the scene out of the movie. And then he was like, or you could pay me a very high six-figure sum. And they were like, done. And it was like, great.
Back up the dump truck of money.
He did well. I think he did well.
Historically marked the first time that an artist made money.
This movie is famous for a bunch of reasons. It's great.
We also didn't talk about the marketing campaign for this movie. Did you guys know about that?
Yeah, Universal released a bunch of animals from zoos.
No, but it was like one of the first viral marketing campaigns. Like they spray painted a bunch of monkey signs all over like Los Angeles or something like that. And they really sort of like primed the world, the United States, whatever, for this movie. And then when it came out, everybody was like, oh, this is what the monkeys are about.
Right. It's a movie.
But it was a very effective technique for the movie and I think, you know, played into its success. And, you know, it is noted as one of the first times that that sort of like outside marketing or, you know, I guess like the sort of almost pre-Blair Witch. Is this like something that's really happening?
Right.
Or is it for a movie? That's where that sort of came from.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's also echoes of this movie in other movies with the actors that kind of echo them. To explain, the Bruce Willis says to at one point, all I see are dead people.
Oh.
And his name is Cole. And the kid's name is Cole.
And the kid's name is Cole. And then that movie, you know, Sixth Sense takes place in Philadelphia. So that's kind of weird. And
Brad Pitt produced 12 Years a Slave, 12 Monkeys. Hopefully you start with 12. When you, you know, next to each other on the...
Mm-hmm.
Also 12 Angry Men could be in front of that.
And Brad Pitt does this whole monologue in Fight Club about like how the world will be taken over once the apocalypse happens. And he's like talking about the animals stalking through the streets of
– And monkeys.
And monkeys climbing the bridges and stuff. So I don't know. There's some weird echoes throughout moviedom in this movie.
Yeah.
And the coronavirus was created by Christopher Plummer on the set of Knives Out.
Damn you, Plummer.
He wouldn't do that.
No, not
He's our greatest Canadian.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, what did you guys think? Was it rewatchable, Blaine?
Hands down, yeah.
Okay, I'll put my hands down. Did you think it was rewatchable, Blaine?
But I have a gun on you. Please put them up.
He doesn't have a gun.
I don't have a gun. It was totally rewatchable. I love this movie. I think it's like even more genius now that I'm seeing. Like when I first saw it, or when I was remembering it, I was like, oh, like he only goes back one time. But the continuing to go back and him thinking he's insane and she realizing that he's not is a perfect crossover midpoint. It's just like a perfect script, really well done. I love this movie. What about you, Rob?
Yeah, I loved it before and it felt so good to watch. I was like, you know, at the edge of the seat the whole time. Even though, obviously, like I knew the twist, I was still like very excited to see it sort of play out. I think all the acting is amazing in this movie. I really think it's probably Terry Gilliam's masterpiece. Mm. And I've just recently saw Brazil again, and I think that's great. And it's his most self-indulgent and wonderful piece of cinema. But this is like where you get to see Terry Gilliam actually do his best work, you know.
Right.
And he has like just enough detachment from it that he doesn't fuck it up. So I think it's a great movie. It's still one of my favorite movies. It's one of the most fascinating like stories. It comes together the best. I think it's great. What about you, Jam?
Yeah, I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. I don't mean that as an insulting thing to say. It's just I remember really liking this movie, but it's not one. It's just one I kind of assumed was good and didn't always feel like watching. But, you know, taking another look at it really made me appreciate it. Yeah. And how, even just how the structure of it is so unusual, the way we go back and forth from the future to the past to, it's very unique. And
there's some funny parts in it too. Like we were talking about, like, oh, we'll do it right this time. And then he goes back to World War One, or
right.
when they see the cops and they're on the lam and they turn around and they're on this huge jumbotron, like in front of the police. there's some funny moments.
Yeah. It has a sense of humor to it, which, you know, is not unusual for Gilliam movies. And it makes me remember how much I like Terry Gilliam movies and how much I wish he would stop saying stupid shit.
Shut up, Gilliam.
Because, it's really a great movie. Well, you know, the biggest thing for me in rewatching it, because I haven't seen it in so long, like I said, is probably the fact that I've seen La Jetée so many times in the interim. And one thing we didn't mention is the Hitchcock connection, because Chris Marker is a big Hitchcock fan. There's a Vertigo illusion in La Jetée.
Right.
And, like, in Sans Soleil, there's a whole segment where he goes to San Francisco and goes to the filming locations of Vertigo. So to actually, I guess because this was a Universal movie, you know, they were able to actually use footage from Vertigo in that sequence where they go to the movie theater, which, you know, it's just kind of perfect. And
circular,
it made me appreciate it more. I think it just builds on the original as opposed to taking anything away from it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed watching it this time. It was great.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for listening. If you have any thoughts about the movie, you can always email us at rewatchability@gmail.com or tweet at us at rewatchability. Mm-hmm. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast platform. Until then,
go to like geocities.redmonkey.
Yeah, you want to plug your website again?
Yeah, it's angelfire.geocities/redmonkey.jeff.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.